Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer recruiting experts. Now, here's your host, Chris Cousins.
Hi guys, Chris Cousins here from Sports Recruiting USA. This is the Inside College Soccer Podcast, and this is a new episode. We've got a fantastic guest. It's Mark Carr, who is originally from England, but he's now the head coach of Oklahoma University women's soccer team. He's also done a lot of things in the past, such as being the US women's U20 head coach. He's been assistant at UCLA and head coach at San Francisco and a number of other things. Anyway, it's a great episode for coaches, for players to listen to, parents, whatever. But yeah, this episode is actually recorded by my colleagues Dom Williams, who's the equivalent of me but in the US. He heads up all the operations over there, and we've got John Maloney on it as well, who's the head of women's soccer here, based out of the UK. So yeah, that's it really. So I hope you enjoy it. It's another good one. If you've got any questions at all about any of our guests or anything at all regarding what we do, you can always get in touch with us. Find us on social media. Just search for Sports Recruiting USA. So yeah, that's it. So thanks for your time, guys. Hope everyone's well and everyone's safe and healthy. So we'll keep it there. And this is Matt Carr, and this is the Inside College Soccer Podcast.
Fantastic. Okay, hello everybody. I'm Don Williams, Sports Recruiting USA. I run operations here in North America, and we've got two very special guests with us today. We've got John Maloney, who runs our women's operations out of the United Kingdom, and we've got Mark Carr, who is the head women's soccer coach at Oklahoma University for the Sooners, and former U.S. national team. Hey, Mark. Hey, John. How are you guys doing today?
Doing great, doing very, Don.
Yeah, no, you're very well. You're located Don. Where, John? Where are you located?
So I am located in rainy, wet England at the moment, just outside Leeds, so in the north of England.
Fantastic. And you, Mark, where are you at, Mark?
Well, I'm on a little family vacation. The college season here is about to start, we hope, in a couple of weeks. So I've got a little vacation down in Florida with the family, and trying to do some work in between. So thanks for having me, Don and John. It's good to see you guys in person, and I look forward to chatting with both you guys.
So are you catching some NWSL games or MLS games down there?
Yeah, I mean, I've been tuned into the NWSL and just really proud of, you know, just the platform that, you know, US soccer's created, and it's really been incredible to see how they've managed the whole kind of process through COVID, and more importantly, just the exciting games and the level of talent on show. So it's just it's really a great league, and just kind of watching it from the outside. I have some friends who coach in it, and really, really fun to watch. So I've been tuned in as much as possible.
Tell you what, it's come a long way. And we'll get back into the women's football side of things in a minute and how far it's come, Mark, at least since I've been coaching. I started about 30 years ago when, you know, if you read Anson's book, Training Soccer Champions, he talks about that women couldn't kick a ball 25 yards in the air and couldn't head a ball, and how far we've come. And I really want to talk about that. But I'd like to start with your story, Mark. How does a guy from London end up coaching women's national team and under 20 national team, and coaching at, you know, one of the biggest universities in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been an absolute dream journey for me. And like you said, I grew up in London, was an average player, you know, was in and out of kind of youth soccer teams. Charlton, Queen's Park Rangers. I played alongside Rio Ferdinand. He had like lots of contract offers. I had zero. From a young age, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to make it at the highest level. But I always had a kind of fascination for coaching and teaching and learning and growing and improving. And you know, I remember probably when I was like 14 or 15 in my summer holidays or summer vacations, I would spend just down watching training sessions, been part of the community scheme at Charlton, shadowing guys that would go into local primary schools, and just fascinated by their way of connecting and you know, inspiring kids to move to the next level, you know. So fast forward that, I did some summer camps, I think in 2000, and I think one of the camps was in Northern California, and the club approached me and said, hey, listen, we would like for you to kind of oversee our program. And it was a small club in Northern California. And then from there, it just, you know, dream story. I mean, everyone says, wow, like you just seem to land in the right place. And the club sent me on a coaching license, a USSF C license back in the day. And my assessor was Joe Ellis. And, you know, back then I still thought I was a player, and I was, you know, put me out wide and I could ping a ball, you know, that's probably about all I can do. And at the end of the week, Jill just came up to me and handed me a card and said, hey, listen, I'd love to have a conversation with you. We have an open position at UCLA. I'm the head coach at UCLA. And, you know, would you be interested in coaching our women's team down there and being an assistant, a second assistant? It's $7,000. You would live in LA. And, you know, for me, I was like, I didn't really know much about women's soccer in the US. At the time, growing up as a young boy in England, it was not. It was not kind of as mainstream as what it is now. And so I didn't really know much about it. But once I went down there and talked to a few people and made the decision to go down there, that's where kind of the journey began. So started at UCLA, spent 5 years at UCLA. I mean, Jill to the day is probably the biggest influence on me as a coach. I mean, we talk every week. She's taught me so much. So, you know, I went from UCLA, learned. You know, obviously started at that program with her. It doesn't get much better than that. Went to four or five Final Fours, never won one. And then from there, made the decision to become a head coach at the University of San Francisco. So that was in the West Coast Conference. And probably the biggest learning experience for me, Don, there is, you know, you go from a kind of power, you know, a top five team in the country to, you know, a mid-major team. And, you know, been a younger coach, I you know, self-reflecting now is like, I made a lot of mistakes. I thought you could just copy paste, you know, you're at UCLA, you copy paste and it'll all work out. And it wasn't the way. So when I look back, that was a really a great moment for me to grow and learn and evaluate, self-reflect where I was. And so from there, kind of shifted as a family. I met my wife in LA and she was originally from Texas. So that we then, we decided it was kind of right. We were living in California. You know how expensive that is, living there with one kid and having no money. And we decided, hey, listen, it's probably a good time to get back. And my wife's family's from there and they were getting a little bit older. So we went back there and I jumped back into the club game. Incredible experience there with Lone Star. Didn't coach the top teams. And I deliberately chose to work with the second tier kids. And, you know, that's where I kind of, once again, kind of took what I learned at USF and, you know, refined my methodology and how, you know, how you work with players and how you should value every player and whether you're number one on the roster or number 26 on the roster, like everybody's important. So that hit home and that was the philosophy that I took there. And, you know, at the same time, the training center program was starting. I know you guys are familiar with that, Don, probably in California. And Jill, you know, Jill and April Cater at the time needed some type of identification system in Texas, because Texas is such a big market and an important market. So North Texas, South Texas, you know, you got Dallas and you got Houston and Austin. So I was kind of charged on a shoestring budget of, you know, putting together a program, one that would develop a curriculum, but also would really unite the club coaches and connect the club coaches with us to identify and develop kind of, you know, once a month or bi-weekly our young kind of female soccer players. So from there, it spiraled into a development coach position, a full-time position with the federation. They sent me to the East Coast. So that was another region that I worked with. Coach the under 15 girls national team, which is the, you know, the youngest age group. I mean, you girls that are just, their dream is to be on the national team and wear the crest, and, you know, really incredible experience there. Then the national team coaches or the federation decided to to go to full-time positions. So I graduated with the 15s, was with them for 2 years, then went with, graduated with that same age group for the, with the U17s, took that same group, fired for the, for the under 18 world, for the under 17 World Cup, which was in Uruguay in 2018. And really, really challenging, you know, really eye-opening experience. Like when I look back right now, you know, I wish I had done better. I wish I had made some different decisions, but that's life, right? And, you know, you have to go through the experiences to learn. And, but really just really my time with the Federation and finishing up with the 20s, you know, before Laura stepped in was just, you know, a privilege and just an honor to be able to work alongside some of the highest level kind of people in their professions within the Federation, but also with the top players in the country. So blessed, honored, learned a lot, humbled. And yeah, I mean, it just was just a dream story for me.
That's unbelievable. And then Oklahoma comes calling, or you were looking to make a change, or how did that work?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously US soccer was in a little bit of transition and, you know, for me, and I even say this to the recruits that I talked to today, I mean, you know, spent an amazing 8 years at US soccer, incredible people, incredible experiences, traveled the world, learned a lot, learned so much about the game, about the process of developing players and, you know, had a couple of options kind of in the fall, like the late fall and, you know, my decision, you know, I wanted to, if I was going to make the decision to move and jump to a school, it had to really align with the high performance aspect of it, or be able to match it or better it. And when I kind of sat back and evaluated University of Oklahoma, it was, I was always curious about it and just, you know, and not until you're on campus do you realize what just an incredible institution it is, but also the level of facilities and the expectation of excellence and championships and development, it just hits you. So for me, it was an easy decision. Everything that they have aligned with kind of what I stand for and what I had experienced with US soccer, with US soccer in the 8 years before. For me, it's about development, winning at the highest level. Those things, I think, influence each other. And the other piece I would say, Don, as well, is that you know, when you're in a camp, you're in a youth national team camp, it's seven to 10 days of just this intensive development environment where you are trying to squeeze every little piece of development into the player, squeeze their brains for 16 hours a day. And when they leave from camp, you know, I felt there was this void and I missed the day-to-day part of it. So, you know, being back on in a day-to-day environment and being able to really influence young women more and build those connections and, you know, build those relationships and really have a day-to-day model, that was important. So that aligned. And then I think the other piece for me was a family decision, you know, like, you know, I have a wife and two young kids and my daughter now is she's a little budding soccer player and she has, you know, seeing her grow, seeing her want to achieve and trying to be next to her with that, that's important to me. And you know, my son's soccer career started at 4 years old and finished at five, so he's retired already. But yeah, I mean, it's a family decision, you know. I'm in one place, I have a kind of a new project, but just it all kind of fell in line, so that's where I'm at now.
Can I ask Mark just the, I guess, the difference between obviously the national team camps, as you've kind of touched upon, with the short amount of time that you have with players, then going into the college game, did you find that really difficult?
No, I mean, it's different. I think, you know, with the national team, you know, with the national team, you have to collaborate with a lot more people in the development circle of the players, you know? So for me, it's actually, John, to your point, like I've taken a lot of those processes that I worked with in the national team and implemented them now at the University of Oklahoma. And, you know, I think when you look at the recruiting process now, like having a plan for every player is important. Like, you know, I learned this, like when you're with the national team, because your roster's changed so much, it's really individual development. Like you could be in one camp in South Korea and have 20 players, and then the next camp you're going to be in Carson, California, and you know only 14 of those players return. So you know you've really got to dig down into the individual development plan, you know, for the player. I think that's the most important thing. If the individual player develops, so does the team. But you've also got to be able to work and understand the player, you know, where they are, what's their performance gap, and then what are your action steps to help them and support them, you know, improve. So it's been an easier transition. But like I said, like the individual piece, I think, I don't know how you guys feel, but the plan for the individual player nowadays is the most important thing. Like parents, players, recruits, even my own players want to know, like, how are you going to help me get better? How are you going to measure that? And how are you going to, you know, how are you going to take my player from point A to point B, and what's your targets and what's your process?
Yeah. I think you're exactly right, Mark. I know, Scott Juniper, I think you probably know Scott, UC Irvine. You know, he did his master's degree on that subject, that the players need to know what their role is. They need to know where they're at as an individual in order to compete at the highest levels as a group, as a team. And it is the individuals that make up the team. And I think you're spot on there, Mark, with that approach. I think maybe too many coaches kind of ignore the individual piece and only focus on the team piece.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I always say, like, you know, my philosophy is, you know, I work up and down this continuum of individual, unit, multi-unit, collective, and you go up and down that all day long in my methodology, whether it's, you know, whether it's principles of play, you know, whether it's development, whether it's training, whether it's individual meetings, whether it's unit meetings, like you have to go, you know, at the end of the day, the examination's in the 11v11 at the weekend. So we all understand that as coaches. But, you know, I think having a plan for every player and having, you know, having an endpoint, like knowing where they are and, you know, knowing where they are and how to get them moving forward, I think that's important. And that's a skill set. And that's, you know, I had the privilege of doing it and seeing it in front of my eyes at US Soccer for 8 years, in the sense of, you know, I was able to stand next to Jill and watch, you know, just in the background on the, you know, in the back of training, watch what Rose Lavelle looks like up close. And then now I'm able to work backwards and see a U17 national team kid and understand like what that gap is. And then what are the steps you have to take to really close that gap, you know? So it's about clarity. It's about honesty. It's about understanding the player. And then it's about collaboration in terms of creating a plan that can help that player. And I don't know if you guys agree, but you know, gone are the days where it's just any of us telling a player, this is what you need to do. I think you have to work together and be collaborative to, you know, bring them to a point that you know already. So I know the end point, we know the end point as coaches, and our job is to kind of pull them there slowly, you know, at their own pace.
Yeah, and that's, for me, it's difficult. You know, I started coaching, I think I'm my 31st year now. So things have changed a lot. And I was raised in the day where just do what I tell you to do. And we accepted it perfectly fine. Coach told you to go, you know, run 7 miles. You go run 7 miles. You don't question it. He told you to stand on your head in the corner. You went and did it. And you didn't dare question it. And if you did, your parents said, what's wrong with you? Why are you questioning your coach? But it's certainly been an evolution. And I will say it's in a positive way. I will say that players are thinking about the game now in a way that they never thought about it before. And I think it's showing, it's certainly on the women's side, it's showing in the development of the types of players that we're creating. And I'm hoping, maybe you can tell us, I'm hoping U.S. soccer is seeing it that way too, because the rest of the world is catching up, especially on the women's side. It's not what it used to be. It was first World Cup. I think it was U.S. and China, basically. Everybody was talking about maybe Norway thrown in there a little bit. Mm-hmm. But now we've got 7 or 8 countries that people are talking about being right on par with the U.S. And I don't know. What do you think? It's probably in a positive way, right, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I definitely agree with you. I think you're seeing more financial resources and attention to the women's game across the world. And, you know, I think that's a positive. I think that's a positive in general because, you know, competition forces you to look inside, look at where you are and, you know, and what your next steps are, you know. So for me, I think, you know, I think we're in a positive way. I mean, you just look at the NWSL and some of the young players in there. I think it's a really incredible platform for our young players, our youth national teams. They're in transition a little bit. So I can't comment too much, you know, in terms of where they're at. But at the end of the day, it's you know, it's an opportunity, I think, gone like when there's challenges and, you know, we can't get to where we want to go. It's we've got to be creative and find ways. And, you know, I think all of us as coaches, whether it's the college, national team, professional, youth, grassroots, we all have a responsibility to help move the game forward, the women's game forward, but also, you know, be creative and find ways to try and develop the players we have in front of us, you know. So I see it as an opportunity. You know, I think, you know, you know, I've had lots of people ask me the questions of, you know, ECNL versus DA versus US club. And I think when you think of development, I think as a coach, development for me is firstly is what's the daily environment, you know, what's the daily environment from Monday through Friday. Training is the most important thing to me. Sometimes more than the games. I would say to you, you know, the coach, what's the coach in terms of, you know, how does he work? You know, how does he bring clarity to the environment? What's his plan for you as an individual player within that environment, whether you're the player on the first team that wants to be on the national team or whether you're, you know, the 26th player on the group, you know, what's his plan? What's his process? What's his periodization? What's his expectation? How does he over communicate that? And, you know, how as a coach, can you bring a player from point A to point B? So I think you need to look at that. I think, of course, we want best of the best. You know, anytime best players are playing against best players, we could be the worst coaches in the world. But if the best are playing against the best, then there's naturally going to be improvement and acceleration in development. And then the final piece, I would say, would be the development platform, you know. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty. But what I'm finding is this generation of players, their parents are now more educated because they're coming from, you know, themselves as parents, like they're educated because they played college soccer or they were part of youth national team. So it's actually really exciting. And I think, you know, parents are an important piece of this, you know, like I'll go back to my time with the 17s. I would get on a phone call with a player and we would talk about what is the plan, what is the gap we need to close, how do we close it? And on the call would be the parents, would be the club coach, would be the college coach, would be, you know, the nutrition coach, the strength coach, the technical coach, the grandparents, even if they wanted to be on there. But it's everybody has a responsibility, you know, everybody has a responsibility. And that's how I look at it in this country right now.
So, okay. All right. So you kind of led a nice little segue into maybe talent identification as one of the areas I wanted to talk about. So I see, you know, I'm very involved in the Twitter coaching world, listening to all these coaches talking, all the webinars that we've all probably been in on with college coaches, but also with club coaches. And the perception that I'm seeing is that it's a bias system. You must be with the DA or the GA. Of course, the DA doesn't exist. Whatever's going to take over. You must be with an MLS team. You must be in the GA. You must be inside the system. Otherwise, you get ignored. And, you know, I always argue that, look, if you're the best player in your entire state, people are going to hear about you no matter what. And somebody's going to pick up the phone and call U.S. Soccer because I've been that guy. I've been out and seen a kid in a lot playing and said, oh, my Lord. And then I picked up the phone and called somebody in U.S. Soccer and said, you need to know about this kid. And the kid's been invited into camp. So How does this really work, Mark, let's start on the U.S. Soccer level with talent identification.
Well, it's changed a lot. I mean, like I said, back in the day when I was, you know, April Heinrichs put together a development team of myself and a couple of other coaches, we were responsible for the training centers in areas of the country, you know, and we would work alongside the clubs, you know, because they know the talent and they see the talent on a daily basis. So there was a lot of collaboration there. I thought it was a good model. You know, you go into a market like Dallas where it's very high octane, highly intensive, highly competitive, players recruiting, clubs recruiting each other's players. So to get them for one night of the week on the same page and agreeing and seeing, okay, this kid's at the top level, it was really an incredible experience for me in terms of just the collaboration, you know. So from there, you know, I would say you've got your ODP camps, you know, you've got your college ID camps, you know. I think it's about, I keep saying it, it's about collaboration and connection. Like you said, Don, like if you see a player, you're going to make a call or call somebody who's going to make a call to say, hey, listen, you should consider this player and begin the process, whether it's, hey, can you send some video to one of our youth national team coaches? So I would say that. And I think where we are at right now, you know, before I left, I think that the talent ID within US soccer was in a really good place. Morelle was tasked with, you know, her responsibility. Morelle was tasked with really setting up and aligning a development platform in terms of a scouting network. You know, and then beneath that, there are three kind of talent managers, you know, East Coast, Central Region, West Coast. And then beneath that are, you know, probably, I would say 90 to 120 network scouts, you know. And I think at any moment, regardless if you're playing, you know, in Louisiana or if you're playing in Southern California or in Alaska, somebody's going to know somebody who can call somebody, say, hey, listen, can you put this kid on your radar or take a look at this kid? So, you know, at the end of the day, the Federation and I think us as college coaches, we're looking for the best players, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a certain environment that we look for. If there's a best player that's, you know, playing on a boys team in a small club that nobody knows in South Texas, then we're going to, you know, we're going to find her, or there's going to be a conversation somewhere. So I think I would disagree with that. Your point that people are saying that it's a rigged system. It's not, it's open. US soccer is very open in listening and communicating, and, you know, may they disagree on terms of selecting a player? Yes, but that's high performance, and that's what talent is at the highest level, you know?
Yeah, I would say the only difficult part, well, not the only difficult part, but the part where I defend US soccer a bit is to say it's a really big country. This isn't This isn't England, where John could be in the Leeds area and be down to London and back home in a day. I can't cover half of California in a day. And when you consider the population of the youth system, well over a half a million, 18-year-olds alone playing women's soccer, that a college coach or a U.S. national team coach or a scout cannot see it all, can't be everywhere. We've all got limited resources, financial, but also man resources, right? Right? Just how many man hours we can put into it. It's a difficult task, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but that's where I think you're absolutely right. That's where we have to rely on relationships. We have to rely on just sharing and putting, I always say this, putting the kid in the middle, and every decision we make is in the best interest of the kid, you know? So I agree with you. I think it is challenging, but then we've got to be creative. Like, we've got to find ways, and whether that's our connections regionally. I think some of the, you know, when I kind of go back to my time with the 17s and kids were trying to make a 17s roster, you know, college coaches were very communicative. I was very collaborative with them. Hey, Mark, I think here's a kid you should be looking at. And I would always really do my best to follow up and look at video and circle back, you know. But I would say this as well. This is probably something that's not out there is, you know, when you're the international, you know, when you're Jill Ellis or you're Vlatko and the world you live in is the women's national team, it's very hard. it's very hard for me, if I'm a US soccer scout looking at players, to recommend a player without being on the inside. So my point being is, like, if I'm the 17s coach and, you know, Don, you call me and go, hey, Mark, like, I've got this player and she lives in Nevada and she should be with your 17s. The measuring stick for me and the lens that I see the game through is USA versus Germany or USA versus Japan. And so, you know, there may be a process of, hey, listen, I want you to consider this kid, but I don't see what Jill saw or what Vlatko sees because I'm not on the inside. So there's that kind of emotional intelligence and understanding of, you know, that's just how it is, you know?
Yeah. And really that segues really well into the college game. And John, you see this too. It's really difficult when we as scouts, I think our scouting staff is what, 85 now worldwide, and a scout brings us a player or a coach brings us a player that says that we should send this player to Mark Carr. This player deserves to be at Oklahoma. And we look at the player and we say not even close, because, you know, John, you're doing the same thing, right? And you're seeing your player go to Hofstra, right? Or you're seeing your player at Rutgers, or you're seeing your player at UCF. And you're seeing whether they succeed or not. So you've got that measuring stick to see, well, she did, look, 2 years, she's not even started there. Or look, as a freshman, she came in and started. And we can start measuring players against those players. Because if I send you a player, Mark, and she doesn't play for you for 4 years, I failed. I made the wrong recommendation. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Or maybe your standard just raised from when you got her. But I think for a club coach, or a high school coach, or in the United States, oftentimes they don't have that measuring stick that you're talking about, Mark.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. I mean, it's I get the question a lot, like, how do I get involved with the scouting piece? And I think it's about educating yourself. It's about, it's about learning more and better understanding players. And I think a simple idea is, you know, if there's a top national team player, you know, a club player, let's say, who's currently on our under-17s, and, you know, you have a daughter and you have this perception of where your daughter should be, go watch these other top kids that are where your daughter wants to be and then see what that gap is, you know. I think that's it. I think the ongoing education that US Soccer has been doing, like I said, Morel has done really an incredible job to try and connect and continue to connect with club coaches. It's not always easy, to your point, that just the size of the country is so big, but back to your point a little bit is you have to learn about the environment. And I'll summarize it by saying, like, just like I said about Vlatko, is like, I don't know what he sees through his eyes on a daily basis when he's coaching the women's team. So it's very hard for me to go, hey, this kid, Susie, she should be in with you, Vlatko. Like, that's not where I'm living, you know? And vice versa. Like, if he has an opinion on a player, he doesn't know my environment, you know? He's not on the inside. And I say that in a respectful way.
No, I think you touched upon it, Don, as well. There's a lot of different kind of facets to get towards when I guess you're picking a player or you're looking at a player. Only, I guess a small part of it is how they play. You've got the mentality. You're going to World Cups with U17s and you go into, say, the CONCACAF tournaments. That must be something that you look at within a player as well, whether they'll be able to kind of handle, I guess, even at such a young age of 17, 18, that pressure of playing in those big games.
Yeah, you cut out a little bit, John. Can you just repeat your question a little bit?
Yeah, I was just saying about the mentality of players, because it's such a tough environment at kind of youth national team level. And we see it over here in England as well, when you're going away to whether it's Youth World Cups or CONCACAF tournaments and they're away for kind of weeks on end. That must be something that you look at as a player as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's, these young players grow up really quickly and, you know, the level of adversity that they're subjected to. And when I say adversity, I mean, you know, let's peel it back. I mean, these are 16, 15-year-old girls who leaving their families, having to you know, manage school, been gone. I mean, the number of conversations we had of, you know, trying to support them from an academic standpoint, because they're not professionals, they're still kids and they're still going to school. And then, like you said, having to perform on the highest level, at the international level, whether it's at a CONCACAF championship or, you know, if it's at a World Cup, it's just, it's a whole new level of experience, you know, and it's different. And kids that go through those experiences, you know, they're better for it, whether it's a good experience or it's a hard experience, they're just better for the experiences. So, yeah, I agree with your point totally.
To be fair, it's similar as well to like foreign players, say English players coming to the college game in America. You tend to forget, we have girls that start with us at 15, 16 years of age. You tend to forget at 18, they're going to be leaving home to go to a new country and to go into the environment, especially obviously whether it's kind of D1, D2, mm-hmm. it's a tough environment for them. So is there anything that you look for within an international player? If they were to come over as a student athlete?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with your point totally. I mean, it's even hard for an American freshman player. I would say that, you know, I think an American, you know, American freshman player would always say to me, hey, Mark, like, what's the biggest difference between, you know, being a senior in high school and becoming a freshman? And to your point is, you know, here's a girl that, you know, has been the best player all her life on her club team, and she comes into an environment where she's playing with women that are 4 years older, and now you've got to be able to navigate the me versus we. So, you know, how you understand that and understand your role. You may not necessarily need to like love your role, but you need to, when you're on a team, it's about executing it and just following through. So how they navigate that is hard. But also understanding that, you know, they'll jump into preseason and it's 2-a-days. Physically, it's so demanding. The level of intensity is through the roof. You know, the first preseason scrimmage comes around, you know, they play 10 minutes, you know, and then they don't play in the next game. And then next week school starts and they're trying to figure out, you know, their classes, and they're trying to be, you know, they're trying to impress upon you. They're trying to impress upon your teammates. Like, I understand all of that stuff. So sometimes it's just for them to take a breath and go, this is where I'm at, and I've just got to, you know, improve and just know right now it's not about me, you know. So for me, it's a lot about communication. It's about clarity in their role and expectations. But also at the end of the day, it's me sharing with them that I care, whether they're at this end of the roster and not playing, or they're scoring 15 goals in a season. Like, it's about loving everybody and caring about everybody. So what was your second question again? Sorry, I went on a tangent about my things I look for in international players.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I guess any advice for incoming freshmen, that first year especially, which is tough.
I mean, I would take a little bit of what I just said. It's you know, even international kids, you know, like kids that have had so much success, like, you know, it's, they're not going to hit the ground running right away. They're in a new environment, new friends, new expectations, everything's new. And, you know, they haven't gone through it already. So it's really challenging for them. But I would say, you know, lean on your coaches, you know. Over communicate with your coaches. You know, I really work in a kind of a transparent way where I want over communication. And like I said, whatever end of the narrative you fall, you all matter. And I think just having that open dialogue of how you're feeling, what it's like, and then once again, it's about working together to formulate a plan to help each individual player, because everybody's different, you know. Yeah. But I mean, definitely exciting. I mean, I think for any international player that's looking in the US, I mean, just such incredible opportunities. Facilities are great, lifestyle's great, some incredible schools all around, incredible coaching, you know, professional environments. I mean, Don said it at the beginning, just the level of professionalism in the game in the last 20 years over here is just skyrocketed. And you know, I would even say, like, it's almost like an international residency. It's like a residency for players. It's the closest thing you're going to get in the US.
I had a little something going on outside there. Got a little bit noisy. Sorry about that. Okay. What about on the physical side? Here's what I noticed, Mark. All of the international girls that I brought into the college game, I noticed they really struggled with the, you know, it was the little niggly injuries, I call them, you know, that the hip flexor mm-hmm. tightening up on them and the hamstring tightening up on them. What should they be doing to physically prepare themselves for, man, like you said, it starts at the two-a-days, but then we've got our crazy Friday, Sunday schedule that we end up mm-hmm. getting into with very little time to recover in between. So what's your advice on the physical side?
Yeah, I mean, I think the game's come so far. I mean, obviously, you've got all the metrics and the measurables that you can see in terms of the GPS data. So I think the biggest responsibility is on us as coaches to look at that and manage the loads accordingly. I think, you know, when I talk to our players, it's, you know, high performance for me is how you prepare for that 24/7. And that can be anything from nutrition, your lifestyle, you know, what time you get up, you know, what time do you go to bed? How focused are you on academics? How focused are you on soccer? You know, just your lifestyle. I think there's lifestyle that's a big important piece. Your mentality to recovery, you know. Have you planned out time in the day where you can get into the training room for 30 minutes of recovery here and maybe 30 minutes of a rollout at the end of the day in your dorm room? Sleep is important. You know, I think that's the number one modality is sleep. We preach to our players all the time is are you preparing 24/7 to be able to perform and compete at the highest level? So I think there's responsibility on us, but there's also a big responsibility on the student athlete in terms of their nutrition, their sleep, you know, what's their lifestyle like, how much recovery and rehab do they do so that, you know, when they play game one and then 2 days later we have game two, they're ready to go again.
Great advice. I love it.
Yeah, great advice.
So what are your thoughts on the death of the DEA and now the start of the GA? Leslie Gallimore, of course, who was did a great job at Washington and has been involved in U.S. education, has now taken over the GA. Got a big role there, huh? It's a big responsibility. What's your thought on that, and maybe segue into the state of youth soccer currently in the U.S.?
I see it, like I said to you in the beginning, and unfortunate that the DA, you know, made that decision. But, you know, in challenge becomes opportunity. And I think now the kind of people involved in the GA, you know, they've got a great opportunity to create what they always wanted to create, you know. And I think they've got a great leader in Leslie, and obviously they've just hired Mary Frances as well. Two excellent leaders, two people that have been there and done it, understand the development process. So it's exciting. I mean, I did have a couple of conversations with many GA coaches, and, you know, they're talking about this league versus that league and what do we do with players. And, you know, when that happens, you've just got to look inside. And, you know, I think it's an exciting time for, you know, for the GA and this new platform. I'm curious to see which direction it goes. And, you know, hopefully soon all this COVID stuff goes away and we can get back out and do all of us do what we love and love to see the players on the field and people watching and developing and playing and competing.
Yeah. And I want people that are going to be listening to this to understand that what you said earlier, and it's because people ask me the same thing. Well, should my daughter join ECNL? Should they join the GA? Should they be here and there? Mm-hmm. And I reiterate exactly what you said. It's what gives your son or daughter the best chance at development? What coach mm-hmm. is doing it right? And then people ask me, what do you think of this coach or that coach? And I have to be honest, I need to see them in training. I need to spend time mm-hmm. with them in training to tell you what I think, because wins and losses don't necessarily equal development.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I'm like, there's, you know, just to go through it quickly, development is, you know, it's the plan. It's the coach. It's the how does the coach affect behavior? How does your coach get your daughter from point A to point B? Does he have the best of the best playing together, training together? Is it the best practices on a daily basis? Does he have a thought out process? you know, what is the competition platform? If the competition platform is not as good as the other competition platform, when how is he going to supplement, or how is she going to supplement that development gap? So I think these are, it's case by case. I don't think there's a right or wrong, but it's about learning as much as possible, asking questions, and, you know, observing and being curious and trying to find out as much of that information, because I don't think every environment has a top tier ranking in all those things. So I understand it's difficult, but at the end of the day, I mean, my daughter's 10 and she just went through it, and we made a decision because of those factors. You know, you have to look at those factors and decide what's the best fit, you know.
Oh, what have you noticed as you look around on, you know, on your job with US Soccer? You were watching kids, freshmen in college still, right? Sophomores in college still with the under 20s, right? And mm-hmm. what, give us your thoughts on the influx of international players coming into the US college system. Has it been good for US soccer, college soccer in general? And then B, how has that affected US-based players?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, listen, I think for us as a country, and just from my experiences with US soccer, is when you play a US team, their mentality and their fight and their grit and their determination is going to be there. We're improving massively. I mean, I see, you know, my time spent with the 17s and the 20s, we improved massively. And what I do know is going to happen is with the younger groups, they're going to be even more further along. And that's the natural evolution. But I think having international players, it gives this diversity to the teams, but also gives diversity to the sport in this country, which is an exciting thing. Like you just don't want, you know, being on a team, you just don't want one type of player that does the same thing. And having players that can do different things from different experiences are just going to, one, make the team better, make you better as an individual, but also make the whole college soccer better as well. So I think it's a positive thing, and we can learn, like my mindset is we can learn something from everybody. And, you know, if you have a Japanese player or a French player or a Spanish player, you're not going to compare yourself to them, but you're going to look left and right and be inspired by what they can do. And also at the same time, maybe take a little bit from them. Okay, I want to add a little bit of that to my game, because it's a positive. So it's just a positive for me.
Yeah, you've probably noticed too, John, you've been involved in recruiting women's soccer in the UK now for, boy, a number of years. What a positive increase that we've seen in the women's game internationally too, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think Mark touched upon it really well. It obviously develops the American players' games, but from the international players, and I've obviously been through it myself, it brought my game on leaps and bounds, playing with different cultures, players from different kind of, I guess, different areas of the world. We had a couple of Brazilians on our team who were by far the most technical players that I've ever played with. And I know seeing the girls go into the college system as well, it brings them on as players, but I think more than anything, it brings them on as people. And when you see mm-hmm. these players, and you'll know yourself, Mark, when you see a player come in as a freshman and they graduate as a senior, the difference in them mm-hmm. as in them as people is massive. Mm-hmm. And for me, obviously, we want players to have great experiences going over to America as student athletes, but seeing that change is probably the biggest thing and the most rewarding.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we're master teachers and we're developers of people, you know. I think that's the most important thing. So, you know, it's how do you develop the holistic person, and, you know, holistically, and how do you develop them? And I think, you know, the starting point for me is, you know, you have all these learning objectives, which is great. Like on day one, we're going to work on this. On day two, it's about this. On day three, it's about this. And then as you go on this little pathway, then you get real life experiences happening. Yeah. You know, how do kids juggle academics? They had a loss on the weekend. They didn't play, but we're still working on this. And then that ultimately gives you that development platform, merging your learning objectives with the real life experiences, which, to your point, it's just an incredible experience that really just, like you said, from year one to year four, you know, these student athletes come in as young, you know, young girls, and they leave as women, and it's just an incredible opportunity. So,
okay, Mark, here, this is a loaded question, and I'm not even sure how to couch it. But parents come to me all the time, or players, I want to play D1 soccer. Mm-hmm. I want to play, and they put that label on it, D1 soccer. And I try to explain, look, you know, Stanford can play another Division I team and beat them 15-0. Just imagine mm-hmm. what the standard is, right? Where then Stanford mm-hmm. could go and play a Division II school, and it's a 3-2 match, right? Mm-hmm. What's your opinion of the label in this idea that my daughter has to play Division I soccer? And yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say this, it's about the right fit. It's about everybody's pathway and everybody's journey is different. You know, of course, everybody wants to play for the perennial teams, and that's great to have that ambition. But, you know, it's not always real. You know, it's very difficult. It's very challenging. I think it's important, back to the education piece, that, you know, as parents, we educate ourselves on what does that level look like. You know, look at the rosters, look at the backgrounds. But, you know, there's, you know, 360 Division I teams at all different levels and all different opportunities. I would say this, the first thing, there's not going to be too many players that are going to make $1 million playing soccer. So at the end of the day, like, the academic part is something that's really important. I think you have to look at that first, and then complement it with a soccer program that's a good fit for you in terms of, you know, style of play, coaching philosophy, student athlete experience, resources. Do you want to be a starter at a lower tier school, or do you want to be a contributor, you know, in your second year at maybe a top 10 school? There's just so many. I think the exciting thing is this: there's so many opportunities and options, and it's important that you remain open-minded. You know, it's important that you don't look at the person to the left and to the right of you and say, because they're doing X, Y, and Z, that I have to do that. It's everyone has a personal journey, and everyone will find a fit for themselves that's right for them.
Yeah, I love it. And it's amazing to me, Mark, how many parents say that, you know, they'll name a Pac-12 or an ACC or an SEC team or a Big 12 team and say, that's where we want to play. And the first question I usually ask is, how many games have you watched? And the answer is usually zero.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I mean, it's about educating yourself by watching the video, but even more so, get up close to it and see how quick it is. Like, stand, watch it on the sideline and, you know, in the stands, and just up close is a little bit different to on TV, and, you know, to get a better understanding. And then I think the other important piece is to seek out expertise and knowledge of people that are in your development circle, whether that's coaches, whether that's you go to a college ID camp, college coaches, however, just gather as much information as possible and do your homework. I think that's an important part, I would say.
Yeah, I can't really reiterate what you said about seeing it in person. When you see some of these athletes blow by you on the field, and you realize that as a male athlete that you couldn't have kept up with them if you had wanted mm-hmm. to back in the day, how phenomenal they are as athletes. It's humbling, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think you've got to know, like, your strengths, what you're good at. You've got to be honest with yourself. And like I said, is be realistic. You know, like, of course we all have dreams, and, you know, that there's nothing wrong with that, you know, but also at the same time, there's got to be an element of being realistic and understanding where you are, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, as we wrap this up, John, did you have any other questions for Mark? Because I've just about run out of questions, Mark. You've done jumped ahead on a lot of my stuff, and I really appreciate it, Mark. I really do.
No worries.
I'd just like to ask you, Mark, obviously, I know you talked about being close with Jill Ellis. Do you think mm-hmm. you could have a little word in her ear and just talk about maybe the England national team job and see if you can get her over here?
But you want me to ask her to go over? You want me to say?
Yeah,
that?
See, she'd be interested because I think that could be the key thing to close the gap even more to get the England girls closer to America.
Yeah. No, listen, Jill, I've known her for 20 years, and she's just we all know, incredible coach, but even better person. And you know, I know she's in a really good place. I mean, to go out on top with two World Cups, it's pretty hard to do. You know, both on the as a men's coach or a women's coach or any coach for that matter. So, I'll talk to her for you, John, and see what she says.
You're a good guy, Mark. Thanks for that.
Well, I want to wrap this up again just by thanking you, Mark, for taking the time out of your family vacation to spend time with us. And it's been, I think that what you've given us here is a really good insight that's going to help a lot of youth players in this country and overseas too. I really appreciate it.
No, definitely.
No, thanks for having me. And thanks for having me. And, you know, I'm on social media, on Twitter, and, you know, if people have questions, I'm very open. Like I said, I'm not a genius by any means, but I've had some good experience. And for having me, you guys, I've enjoyed it. And I'll look forward to seeing both of you guys soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.